Hey, this is the Tangled Podcast. Today I'm talking to Zach Weiss, who runs a business called Elemental Ecosystems. I met Zach a few weeks ago when I took his workshop, which looked at how to understand and manage water in the landscape. The workshop was based around what he does for work, which is a mix of environmental restoration and landscape engineering. Zach works under the assumption that many of our problems come from a misunderstanding and poor management of water. By building dams, repairing eroded stream banks, and many other tactics, Zach helps people improve their land's ability to catch and hold water. If you hear a name or concept mentioned during the interview and would like to know more, you can go to tangledpodcast.com for links to everything we talk about. Okay, here's the interview. Zach, thanks for sitting down to chat.
Oh, a pleasure to be here.
You don't do the type of work that is all that common. How do you describe what you do to people who aren't familiar?
You know, to be honest, the description I use of what we do changes based on who I'm talking to. Really trying to put it into terms that they will understand, because it is a bit unique. So that ranges from anything from watershed restoration, water and soil conservation, ecosystem regeneration, to whole farm system development and planning, and holistic farm management, all sorts of things in shades between those. But really boiled down, the essence of what we do is try and help improve relationships between humans and the landscapes that they're stewarding.
Can you give me a quick sort of run through of the role played by the different parts of a landscape in the water cycle?
Yes, yeah. So it's this interconnected loop. So there's no real place to start or to end. But so I'll just start working through the system as it appears to make sense. So you have the rain coming in, bringing that humidity to the landscape. The vegetation has a big impact on how that rain infiltrates into the landscape. So in a cool, shaded area, it's going to infiltrate much more rapidly than in a place that lacks vegetation, preventing that moisture from being able to infiltrate into the soil. So that's one big role that the vegetation has. Then the type of soil has a big impact on how that moisture is received. Then that moisture goes into the earth, it charges different veins and aquifers, and then returns in the spring form of springs and creeks and rivers that ultimately bring that water slowly back through the system. Now, a lot of the moisture moving through the system is actually evaporated again by the sun and then rains again in place. So more than half of the rainfall we receive is from what they call the small water cycle, water that's evaporated on land and then rains again on land. And then vegetation also has this big impact in increasing the humidity, lowering the pressure, allowing more storm cells to enter the region, and then also actively seeding the moisture in the air with the nuclei, the hygroscopic microorganisms that allow that water vapor to condense as droplets and eventually fall as rain. So it's really this interconnection between heat dynamics, phase changes of water, vegetation, and then the surface of the earth.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's when you explain it, it seems, you know, super simple, and yet we've managed to do a pretty good job of not letting it function the way that it should really function. But yeah, anyway, so one of your main mentors is Sepp Holzer. Would you tell me who he is and what the main sort of lessons you took away from him are?
So Sepp Holzer is also called the Agro Rebel. And he is a revolutionary, rebellious farmer from the Austrian Alps that started out taking his farm over at a young age and deciding that he was going to first and foremost look to nature, that nature was perfect and that any imperfections came from the human side of things. So he went about developing this farm in the way that he thought was correct and good, and made a really beautiful place, the Kramaterhof. And this is still a working production farm that's also an education center run by his son, Josef Holzer, these days. And so as this farm started to develop notoriety, people started to really see it as an example of what's possible when humans work with nature. Then he began being called to all sorts of different landscapes and really helping transition those landscapes from states of disturbance and sickness to a state of health and balance. And so he continued to develop notoriety, working on bigger and bigger projects, eventually working on projects where he's basically turning deserts back into paradise. And so I got the opportunity to work and learn from him for a number of years. I still visit him every year. I still learn a lot more from him every time I visit. But the fundamental pieces that I learned from him is really the general approach and strategy of looking towards nature, of observing water, of observing plants and animals, of digesting the information that they're giving you, and then putting that into action, making small movements that then you observe more, that then lead to bigger movements. So he really taught me how water moves through the land and the atmosphere, how that water can be infiltrated and used to enhance a landscape, and how the vegetation that's benefiting from that water can be structured in a way where it works as a natural ecology, where all the different pieces are helping each other. And because of that, you get something that's much more productive than a monoculture farm or an artificial system overlaid over the natural system.
Yeah, that's a good point. Are there any areas where you've ended up developing a different take or a different opinion than Sepp over the years?
As far as the big picture of things, not so much. As far as the details and the general approach, yes, certainly. I think on the nature side, we're quite closely aligned, about as aligned as you could be. The differences more come in the human management of side of things. And he was raised differently in a different time. And so when he reaches confrontation, he pushes back with equal or even more force. Whereas I try and take a softer approach and basically anticipate and prevent confrontation before it happens. But then also in my own practice, I really try and stay focused on the clients that I'm working for and what their goals are for the situation. Whereas Sepp does first and foremost what's best for the landscape, what's best for the land and the wildlife, without so much concern of what fits the people exactly. I go about it with approach that's maybe a little bit more modest in some ways in terms of the impact on the environment, but where I make sure that whatever interventions we're making really make sense and fit the goals that the clients have laid out for themselves. Not everyone wants to be a full-time farmer, but lots of people still want to live in a healthy landscape. They want to be a positive impact to their surrounding area. And so those kinds of goals can be achieved more modestly. Whereas someone who really wants to take up a life in farming is going to do things a little bit differently.
Sure. A lot of that sounds sort of similar to Alan Savory's approach of holistic management. Has that framework had any impact on how you work?
It's something I definitely know of and I'm aware of. I'm always very much considering the goals of the people and the lifestyle that they're aiming for. But I do it in a more fluid manner that's not so much regimented.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's something I definitely employ and use, but not with the spreadsheets and the questionnaires and things of that nature.
Are there any other people who, like either directly in regards to water and landscapes or just in terms of your worldview, anyone who has had a big impact on the way you think?
Oh, lots of people. Yeah, it's hard to know where even to parse out which names to include here. One of the big ones early on was Tom Brown Jr. and John Young with wilderness tracking and awareness and bird language and all of the things you can interpret from the natural landscape, the information that it's always providing to you. So that was something I was just fascinated with as a kid. And that learning and those experiences still very much guide my work today. Anastasia and the Ringing Cedar series had a big impact on my worldview and what I want to do with my time. I had another mentor in Montana that taught me all about ecosystem greenhouses and natural insect management, passive solar geothermal greenhouse design. So he taught me a lot of the basics of growing because he was a fourth generation plantsman. His name is John Hemighaus. And then I came across Sepp, who really put all the pieces together and blew the lid off of all of it, putting it into something that's really actionable and on a scale that was unlike anything else I've experienced up to that point. I'm finding all the time more and more people that I'm learning from and inspired by. Rajendra Sin, the waterman of India, is a big one of my current mentors, where they've created this civilian movement over 30 years that's restored 7 rivers and 250,000 wells, impacting 1 million people. So beginning to see how these same exact techniques that SEP is applying and the same general approach can be applied on a larger scale in a movement and really achieve some absolutely phenomenal results.
You're mentioning sort of general principles that can be scaled up and down. How much of what you do is sort of based just around universal principles that can apply everywhere versus having to change your tools and tactics depending on the climate or the environment or where you are?
You know, it's always a balance between those two things. The general guiding principles typically stay the same from property to property, but what your actual action is can change night and day. What I might do on one property, I might do exactly the opposite on a different property, depending on the climate, the goals of the people, the landscape itself. So it's very much, I liken it to the Tao, because I've been reading the Tao recently, where they say the universal Tao, the true Tao, is one that cannot be written. And I think this kind of land management practice is in some ways similar. There is no formula or recipe that's going to apply everywhere, but there are basic principles that you can generally follow. But the magic really comes in understanding and deciding how specialized to be with each place and how to interpret those principles in a way that makes sense given the context.
I know you're obviously talking about how varied your work can be, but would you mind just picking one project and trying to sort of paint a mental picture of literally what you're doing to change the landscape for someone who's trying to imagine what kind of work you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be speaking about a particular project, but this is a pattern that we see again and again of essentially a farmer that doesn't have enough water. They're limited in what they can grow by their water supply. Yet seasonally, they have a ton of water rushing through their property. So they have times when they have way too much water, and then lots of times when they don't have enough water. And so what we're doing is looking at the places where that water is going, how it's leaving the property, and how it can be collected, held, and infiltrated back into the landscape. So on this project in my mind, there were two main gullies where all of the water, when it rained, was being channeled to these two gullies. And so in both of those gullies, we began to make water retention features that catch that excess of water when it comes through, store it in water bodies. But then because of the way the water bodies are constructed, they're also allowing that water to passively enter back into the earth, which is benefiting the aquifers and all of these more long-ranging things, but it's also creating a very hydrated, lush area around the water body for the property owner themselves. So we're basically coming into places where there's extremes seasonally, too much and then too little water, and then putting in shock absorbers to help balance out those extremes. So that in the times when there's a ton of rain coming down, there's places for that to go without creating erosion and without creating damage. And then in the times of drought, there's those sources of water that the farmer can then draw upon.
You mentioned your practice of making sure that your dams or your ponds or the water bodies can infiltrate into the soil. I don't have personal experience building dams or ponds, but I know a lot of people end up doing it with like a sealed liner. I'm pretty sure that's quite common. I'm assuming you're not a fan of that approach.
That's putting it lightly. For me, a liner is an absolute last option if nothing else can be done. And then you really have to consider, is it really worth it? Is this really the natural solution? Because what you have with a liner pond is you're basically creating a tank. So it's not allowing any water to infiltrate. You do create a water vessel where you can store it, but it really has no impact on the hydrology or landscape. And it also uses a lot of intensive materials, either rubbers or plastics. And then the very best liner pond is going to fail in 20 to 30 years and then need to be reconstructed. So you're putting in a lot of fossil fuel, a lot of energy, a lot of expense for something that's very temporary. We're not even talking about lasting a full human lifetime. Whereas when you do these water bodies in an earthen way, you're using some fossil fuel again, but you're not using any unnatural materials. You're using the earth on site and reorganizing it and creating something that is returning that water to the aquifers, to the earth, and that's going to last until the next ice age if done well.
Right. Just on that note of building dams and ponds, I was speaking to Darren Doherty from Regrarians, and he was saying he's had a couple of examples where on clients' properties they've built water bodies, but then because their land management has been so good and they've built up such organic matter in the soil of the rest of their property, there's been so much infiltration directly into the soil that there's nowhere near enough runoff to even fill up the dams anymore. Have you ever seen that kind of thing happening, which is sort of in one way a good problem to have because your landscape function is improving, but then you're sort of left with a water body that's not doing what it was designed for?
That's an interesting take. You know, you can certainly improve the soil to the point where you have very little runoff, and that's a great thing if you can achieve. The types of water bodies that we're creating, that's not really an issue because what we're doing is we're finding the levels that the water naturally is being held up by. So whereas a more traditional dam is going to require surface overflow, water flowing over the surface of the earth to fill, the water bodies that we create are tied into the natural veins of the earth. And so in a situation like what you're talking about, where let's say we can improve the soil to the point where there's no runoff and it's all infiltrated into the landscape, that water with our types of systems will still make it to the water bodies, and the water bodies will still be full because that water is moving through the soil down to the impermeable layers and then moving into the water body because that's tied into those natural geological veins of the earth. Whereas if a water body is built in a way that it doesn't tie into those layers, you're dependent on the surface overflow in order for the water body to have water.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. I think I have heard you mention before that sometimes you have not conflict, but maybe disagreement with people who come from different backgrounds, say from permaculture, where there's the idea of trying to build a water body at a high point on the site so that you can use gravity to feed other areas of the property. Is that sort of similar to what you're talking about here?
Yes, yeah, in a way. And just to clarify too, with that point, a lot of it, there's a lot of things in permaculture specifically that make very good sense in theory, but when actually applied to practice, there's all of these things that you then have to look about. So like you mentioned, storing water high on the property, a great thing to do when possible. It makes all the sense in the world, but if you don't factor in the soils and how water is moving the material around and all of those variables, that theory or concept might lead you to put a water body somewhere where it's not natural and where it's never going to work. And so it's important to realize that these theories are just theories. And this is one of the big differences that I appreciate about SEP. Whereas with permaculture, you have this movement founded in theory, where people came up with the theory first and are now trying to put the theory into practice. And so you have all this friction and rub as the theories don't actually play out perfectly on the ground. Whereas with SEP stuff, he did not start with theories at all. And he barely has theories now. He started with practice and he saw what worked and what didn't and kept refining the practice. So his system is something that really applies to the real world and you can put in place because it's practice-based, not theory-based.
On that topic, I know as well you're a big fan of practical training as opposed to classroom education. Can you talk about how you think the best way to learn is for people? Well, I suppose in any field, but particularly for what you do.
Yeah, the best way is to get your hands dirty. What I always am recommending people to do is to build models. So say you have this landscape and you want to put in a big water body. You're not sure if it's going to work or not. You're not sure how to build it. We have this great thing where we can create a little model. Maybe this is just a few square meters in area. You can use the materials that you'll be working with. You can use a shovel in your hands and your feet so you can really feel the nature of the material. You can feel if it's taking compaction or not. You can feel at what moisture you need it to be able to compact it. You can build your little test model exactly how you would think you would do it. And then you can simulate rainfall with a watering can and see, does it hold water? What happens in a big flooding event? Are your spillways sized big enough? And so you can get all the information you need to know from nature through this practice before you actually do things on a big scale. Whereas so much of the learning is done in theory and it doesn't actually lead people towards doing it because there's still so many hangups that they have in converting that theory to practice. So I'm a strong proponent of just start practicing and don't be afraid of the mistakes. Lean into the mistakes because that's where the learning really happens.
I'm just sort of thinking now for people who don't have, you know, a big property to work with, that they might just live in the suburbs. Are there any sort of things that they could start thinking about as a way to try to improve their miniature little square of the water cycle?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the big things I like to do here is look at your land that you have managed and look at the impact that you're creating on it compared to what it naturally used to be. So in a suburb, maybe you're in an area that used to be forest. Maybe it even used to be wetland. Maybe it was grassland. Regardless of what it was, at some point, it was all an earthen surface that allowed water to infiltrate. Now, by nature of having the home there, you're going to have this home that has 100% runoff of everything that hits that area. You're going to have a driveway and paths where, again, most of the water that used to infiltrate runs off. And so one of the best things someone in the suburbs can do is to move that water to certain places and allow it to infiltrate. And so what this looks like is a rain garden or a hugelkultur garden or some kind of means of taking that water that's all hitting the roof of the house and then trying to distribute it and still have it infiltrate into the earth on site rather than just running downhill into the street, into the sewer drains, and out to the ocean.
Yeah. Just to go back quickly, in case someone's not familiar with hugelkultur, would you mind just quickly defining that?
Yeah. So hugelkultur, I like to define it as a waste management strategy, where instead of burning your organic wastes, you are putting them into an earthen berm to facilitate the composting. And so this might be a lot of woody debris, for example, that would otherwise be piled and burned or hauled away to the landfill. But instead of doing that, use that carbon resource, all of that lignin, bury it in a hugelkultur mound, a raised bed garden, and allow the fungi to start decomposing all of that woody debris, forming this very nice sponge-like soil that's rich with life, so that when the rain does come, it's able to absorb that moisture and make it more available throughout the year.
There are so many frameworks and ideas and people who are really self-confident about their way is the best way to manage land or change land or do whatever. Are there practices that you see that are really popular that you, without necessarily particularly talking about individual people, but just ideas in general that you think are misguided in the sort of space of general land management?
You know, I see very much this pattern that you're talking about where people develop a technique or start working with a technique and think, this is the best thing since sliced bread and it makes sense everywhere. And the reality is that each of these techniques, they have a place and a purpose and a context under which they're very effective. And then they have other places and contexts where they make no sense whatsoever. So my biggest one is the swale. I basically never put in swales. I think that there's more natural and more long-lived ways to achieve the same impacts of those swales. I see a lot of swales that end up causing problems for people one way or another. And I see a lot of swales that are put in without any thought of the actual nature of the site itself. So commonly I'll have people contact me for a consultation or a project and they say, well, we want to know where to put our swales in. And what they don't know is I'm probably going to tell them they actually shouldn't have swales there for one reason or another. Like a consult I just finished up, they have a sandy loam soil. And once you get down about 20 centimeters, it just turns to sand. So the best strategy for holding on to water is to actually hold on to it in that first 20 to 30 centimeters where there's a lot of life and organic matter that helps extend that moisture. Now, say you just are going about it in a permaculture perspective, you'd think, oh, well, I need to put my swales all across the landscape so that I infiltrate that water. But now what you're actually doing is taking that water that would have infiltrated into the topsoil and sinking it into the subsoil that's all sand, where it's all just going to disappear and the plants aren't going to have any access to it. And so you would actually destroy the hydrology of a site by putting a lot of swales in it.
Yeah, good example. Interesting. I know you're a big fan also of finding and tapping springs, which I think I've seen a little time lapse you've done of that, which is so cool. Would you mind describing the process of how you find a spring and then why it's a good thing to try to tap it?
Yeah, so spring water is one of my big passions because it's really the highest quality drinking water. Rainwater isn't really drinking water. It's been distilled by the sun, but it hasn't been mineralized. So it's not the highest quality. Well water has often been over mineralized. So you'll actually have problems, joint problems, and calcification later in life from drinking just well water your whole life. Whereas spring water is the perfect mix, where it's been distilled by the sun, it's been mineralized the proper amount by the earth, it's been oxygenated, it's charged with all of this electrical energy. And so myself, I try and drink exclusively spring water if I can. And I notice a big difference in my own health and vigor. But it is one of my favorite things to do, is to tap springs for drinking water. So the process of finding a spring, some are easier than others. Sometimes they present themselves as just water coming out of the ground. Other times you have to use more subtle cues, like the shape of the land, how the water would have shaped through its movement over time, the vegetation that you see in a landscape, and how that changes, indicating different water lines within the earth. Even the smell of the landscape is something I'll use to help find springs. And you'd be amazed how many times people have springs and don't even know they have them on their property. And the process of tapping these springs is basically, how can you do as little work, as little manipulation as possible to take that water out of the earth where it's coming pristine and clean and enter that into a piping system, maintaining that quality so that it's available for drinking water, for homes, for animals, for irrigation, whatever you're going to be using the spring water for. And so it's kind of like creating a French drain, if people understand that, where you have a pipe with slits in the top of it, not in the bottom of it. You dig out the spring, you lay the pipe in there, you fill it with gravel, and then you cap it with clay, so that the spring water comes out, it fills that cavity, and then it can only leave through the pipe.
What a great system. So just sort of switching topics slightly, I've anecdotally heard about people who've reforested or regreened their properties, and then they start seeing significantly more rain, both compared to what they used to get there and also compared to what their neighbors still get. Have you ever come across that? Because it's so hard to try to measure that sort of thing in a strictly scientific sense, but I've heard that people are pretty confident anecdotally that they're seeing more rain when they start planting more trees.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of anecdotal evidence, and some much more strong too. So for example, in India, where they've done all of this revegetation and decentralized water management, they've lowered the temperature 2 degrees Celsius. This is something that they've measured. They've increased the vegetative cover to 48% from below 10%. I can't remember the exact figure. And now they get the good monsoons every year. Whereas their monsoonal rains, some years just didn't arrive. Now, because they've reestablished the vegetation and the hydrological cycle, they get good, steady monsoonal rains every year. Now, another good example of this is Willie Smith's project in Borneo, where they've revegetated a huge area, reestablished as forest, and they have measured a 10% increase in rainfall, not only for their property, but for their property and downwind of them. So they're restarting this moisture conveyor belt. So when you take on these types of land management, you're not only improving it for yourself from the precipitation cycle standpoint, but you're actually improving it for all of your neighbors downwind of you.
It's incredible. It's so powerful. Have you come up against any sort of well-meaning environmentalists who are still sort of certain that CO2 in the atmosphere is the main driver of climate change? Because I don't know, I think it seems so clear that water plays such an obvious role in cooling, you know, areas of the environment. And if we did that everywhere, then everywhere could be cooler. But there's still such a massive contingent of mainstream science that is only focusing on CO2.
Yeah, and that's the vast majority of what I see, is people focused on CO2, mostly focused on cutting emissions, some focused on CO2 drawdown, but still, even with that, we're working with such a small portion of the heat dynamics. It's something that every time I explain to people, people think, oh, that's so simple. That's so logical. Why aren't people talking about this more? But it's just, it hasn't been in the mainstream narrative. So it's very much a new story that's coming about. Because if you watch, you know, from Al Gore's flick onward, no one is talking about water. They're all talking about CO2 when it comes to climate change. And so it's catching more and more steam, how water is this foundational component and actually the main driver of climate change. But it is still very much a new narrative that is slowly percolating through the general consciousness.
So you were recently in Australia doing a couple of projects. How does this continent, and maybe also how do the people here differ from other places you've worked?
Australia is, and I do not say this lightly, it is without a doubt the place with all of the warning signs of the watershed death spiral, where things are so severe and extreme there. And even though the poor management hasn't been there as long as it's been in some other places, the landscape is so fragile and the precipitation cycle so extreme that you see all of the warning signs. And I look at Australia as, you know, it has changed my whole approach, to be honest, to have seen Australia and how dire the situation is there and how everyone is using it to promote their own narratives and no one is actually looking at the root causes behind it. It just made me realize, man, we are really a lot further along and going a lot faster on that track towards Mad Max, where people are fighting wars over water, than I realized. And going from India, where you see the results of people working with water over a long period of time and how positive of an impact that has on people's lives, and then going to Australia, where it's the opposite and people have just been raping and pillaging the water cycle. And you see that in, you know, the almost the whole continent along the coastlines burning up. I mean, everywhere I was, there was huge fires or evidence of huge fires. And then immediately followed by the flooding. And then you're just waiting for your next drought because all of that moisture that should have soaked into the landscape just ran off into the sea. In the Australians, I see incredibly nice people who are very willing for change, who after recent events have realized change is not going to come from the government. It's going to come from community-driven things. And so I see a lot of potential in Australia if people start to focus on the right things and start to work together instead of everyone taking their own stance and having their own slant and really just trying to push the narrative towards whatever benefits themselves.
Sure. You've also just released a documentary, I think, about your work. Can you tell me about the process of making the film?
Yeah. So the documentary itself isn't released yet. We just released the trailer and announced the project. If people want to learn more, they can go to elementalchange.world. And what this is it really puts this whole narrative of how important water is and how the mistreatment of water is leading to climate extreme. It wraps that up into a story that has a narrative arc and that we hope is somewhat enjoyable to watch of a short film. So it will give people all the information they need to know about why we are where we are in terms of our species and this planet and our climate cycles. But more importantly, it spends a lot of time focusing on the solutions and how all of the solutions are there. There's amazing examples all around the world. There's people already implementing this, but what we need is more people doing it on an even larger scale. And we really need a movement of the common citizens for the common good to create this groundswell.
Hmm. So yeah, you've talked about making models and obviously your film. Are there any other books or people or resources that you would point people towards if they want to learn more about how they can start practically making changes?
Oh yeah, there's so many. Do you want me to focus Australia specific?
Oh, not even. Just whatever comes to mind. I'm just curious where people can try and turn to.
Yeah. So Sepp's work in Austria is where I would start. The Holzerhof, his new farm, and the Kramaterhof, his original family farm, now run by his son. That's an incredible example. Some of his more awe-inspiring projects would be Vivencia de Hisa in Spain, turning this barren wasteland into the largest ecological point of interest in Europe. Tamara in Portugal, a peace research village that has totally changed their management of water and the landscape as a result from being very scarce to now they have a surplus and are charging springs for themselves and their neighbors. In Australia, I was incredibly impressed by Peter Marshall's work, creating just a beautiful farm, working with a diversity of trees, working with the water, how to bring that water back to a landscape where he's basically transitioned what used to be a gold mine into an ecological oasis. Walter Jena, also in Australia, he showed me a wonderful project in Canberra where they created rainforest where it wasn't before. So that's some really excellent work. Those are for me. Yeah, Willie Smits in Borneo, another one. And really, the more you dig, the more examples like this you'll find. But for me, and then obviously Rajendra Sin and Tarun Barnsat in India in the incredible work they've done. You can really turn to any corner of the world and find someone doing this in your own backyard, but it takes a little bit of digging to find them because they don't often make themselves too available to the public circles.
Well, Zach, good luck with launching the film, and thanks for all the work you do, and thanks for chatting today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having this podcast and getting more of the good stuff out into the public stream, and really happy to be here with you.
Okay, thanks for listening. You can find show notes with links to all the people, projects, and books that were mentioned in the conversation by going to tangledpodcast.com. If you have feedback, let me know on Twitter. I'm @Julio_. That's @HOOLIO_. If you like the show, please share it and subscribe to Tangled in whichever app you use. You could also rate the show in iTunes, which would be a huge help. And finally, you can sign up to my email newsletter. I'll let you know when new podcast episodes are released, and I'll send you a monthly list of good books, articles, and other podcasts to read and listen to. You can sign up at tangledpodcast.com. Thanks again for listening. I'll speak to you next time.